You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of February 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, academic and broadcaster Stuart Purvis and Chatham House's Xenia Dormandy will join me to explore the day's news. On the agenda...
I'm not sure whether I can impose an agenda on people who don't want to, you know, how can you put a gun on their heads? It is their country. This is a huge responsibility they have.
Plans are afoot in Geneva, US diplomacy in India, and a look at the BBC and new media ventures, The Intercept and The Marshall Project, all ahead. Then we'll hear from our correspondent, Barrett Austin, in Alabama for the news from down south, and close the show with a review of this week's German television with Kimberly Bradley in Berlin.
Wir hätten dieses Problem nicht, wenn du die Heizungsrechnung bezahlen würdest.
Ich dachte, die globale Erwärmung macht das klar. Auf Ego ist wirklich kein Verlass.
Hab noch ein paar Zeitschriften zum Verbrennen.
All will be revealed. That's all coming up today on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Plenty to look forward to then in the next 60 minutes here on Midori House before we begin. Let's hear from Jonathan Wheatley. He's got the latest world news.
The United Nations has resumed the civilian evacuation of the rebel-held Syrian city of Homs, which has been under siege by government troops for 18 months. The operation was suspended on Tuesday for logistical reasons, with hundreds of civilians still trapped. A temporary truce has allowed around 1,100 to leave Homs since Friday, with the Geneva peace talks making virtually no progress. Meanwhile, international mediator Lakhdar Brahimi has brought forward to Thursday a meeting with senior US and Russian officials backing opposing sides in Syria's war. Opposition spokesman Anas al-Abdah said he hoped the Russians would put pressure on the Syrian government delegation to accept Brahimi's proposed agenda.
Depends if the Russians would ask for that, but we know for sure that they have met with the Syrian delegation last night and they met with al-Brahimi today. I hope that al-Brahimi team has explained to them what the regime's delegation did yesterday. And I do hope that the Russians will put enough pressure on the delegation, on the regime delegation, to be flexible and to accept the agenda as it's proposed by al-Brahimi.
Meanwhile, in Washington, President Obama said world leaders remain determined to find a solution to the crisis.
Right now, we don't think that there is a military solution per se to the problem. But the situation is fluid, and we are continuing to explore every possible avenue to solve this problem, because it's not just heartbreaking to see what's happening to the Syrian people, it's very dangerous for the region as a whole.
A US judge has today ordered the accused Boston Marathon bomber to face trial in November, denying his attorneys the extra time they had sought to prepare his defense on charges involving the largest mass casualty attack on US soil since 9/11. Jahar Zanayev, a native of Russia's restive Chechnya region, could be executed if convicted of killing three people and injuring 264 with a pair of homemade pressure cooker bombs in the 15th of April 2013 attack. The European Union Enlargement Commissioner Stefan Fule has met with the Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych to try to break the political deadlock in the country. Protests against his government are now in their third month. The protests started when Yanukovych turned down a free trade pact with the European Union and instead favoured closer ties with Russia. The Kenya Wildlife Service has begun an aerial census of elephants and other large mammals. The operation will last a week and cover 18,500 square miles of land across parks in Kenya and in Tanzania, along with an area the same size again of rangelands, one of the world's most important elephant sanctuaries. Well, Charles Muzyoki is a conservationist with the KWS.
It's an exercise that we carry out every 3 years with the main purpose of understanding how many elephants and other wildlife we have in this sub-ecosystem, including the Mkomazi National Park in Tanzania. And for this year, we have 130 participants who are going to be involved in this exercise, whose disciplines and expertise and skills and competences are very diverse.
And finally, a composer known as the Beethoven of Japan said today he has suddenly regained some of his hearing ability a week after setting off a furore by admitting he had used a ghostwriter for his popular symphonies and other music. Mamoru Samuraguchi, a classical musician, became known as an inspirational genius for composing, despite originally claiming he was completely deaf. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. That's Jonathan Wheatley bringing us the latest world news. With a bit of Beethoven, kind of, thrown in. You like that one, Jonathan?
Yeah, great. What a bizarre admission. He's now admitted he wasn't deaf after all, and he's now admitted he had a ghostwriter. Incredible story.
It is. Beethoven himself won't be impressed. No. He wouldn't be if he was still around.
Well, he was deaf, of course.
Exactly. Nothing gets past you, Jonathan Wheatley. Jonathan will be back with more news later in the programme. He'll be with us around the half hour mark. Right now, it's 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 6 minutes past the hour, 13:06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on the news, right here in the studio, are broadcaster and academic Stuart Purvis and Zania Dormandy, project director for Chatham House's US programme. Welcome both back to the programme. Great to have you with us here in the studio. We'll start in Syria. Round two of the Geneva talks underway. His new method of talking to both sides independently and in private is, well, maybe paying dividends for Lakhdar Brahimi. He's trying to make substantial progress, albeit rather slow. Today it's emerged that the Syrian opposition have proposed in a confidential document to Brahimi that the regime go through a transitional government imposed, which would oversee a total ceasefire under UN monitoring. Zania, if I can start with you, what do you make of this? Because obviously, and unsurprisingly perhaps, the government not particularly engaged with this idea. It makes no reference to Assad and what his role or otherwise would be. Any legs at all, or is this yet another sort of false dawn, do you think?
So I think, I mean, it depends on whether you want to be a glass half full or a glass half empty person. From the glass half empty side, you know, the reality is, as you rightly point out, this doesn't address any of the issues about which there's fundamental disagreement, i.e. is Assad going to go or not? And from the regime side, this is about terrorism and nothing else. So this is not a step forward. This is yet another kind of empty idea. If you want to look at it the glass half full, the solution, if there is going to be one, is going to almost certainly come around the idea of changing the narrative and changing the frame. And so to the extent that this idea essentially changes the frame, it's not talking about Assad and whether he comes or whether he goes. It's not talking about whether this is about terrorism or not. This is talking about, actually, let's just get rid of the external players. Let's actually focus on the Syrians themselves, and let's agree that anybody who's coming in from outside should go. Now, is this going to have any legs? Probably not, because from the government perspective, of course, Assad, the regime was doing actually pretty badly until Hezbollah came and stepped in and helped out. So it's unlikely that there's a strong incentive for the government to sign up to this, but there is an attempt here, clearly, to change the narrative, and that, I suppose, if we want to be glass half full, we have to hold on to.
Why not? A laudable effort, then. Stuart, in terms of the idea of some kind of transitional body that could be agreed upon by all parties, do you think that's possible at all? It does seem a rather distant prospect at this stage, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it looks like an opening position for a negotiation, but it's, as you say, it's the extreme of, in a sense, it talks about a transitional governing body, which is a reasonable term, but of course it doesn't say what it's transitioning to, other than that there's an absence of the existing regime. But, and you know, as you said, you know, it's a starting point, isn't it? And, you know, they say they're expecting a positive, well, they're hoping for a positive response from the other side. I'd be surprised if they get the kind of positive response they want. But, you know, Rahim needs some kind, something to happen to get going, doesn't it? So, you know, he would, as you say, probably count this as a tiny success in getting something going, not much more than that.
A small step, perhaps. Senior US and Russian officials, you mentioned, Zeni, these other actors involved, of course. They're going to meet Brahimi tomorrow. They'll be keen to obviously keep the talks on track. You know how these things work. What will they be saying to him, those respective sides? I mean, will they be sounding like broken records as well?
So the reality is actually that the Russians and the Americans shouldn't actually be talking to Brahimi, although there's clearly nothing wrong with that. But the only way that there's going to be a movement forward here is if the Americans, the Russians, the Iranians actually talk to the actors themselves. And talk to the Syrians and talk to the Syrian opposition, because that's where, if there's going to be action, it's going to take place. It's going to be because of pressure from outside, from the Russians, from the Americans, to their respective, I wouldn't want to use the word partners, but their respective, the respective actors inside of Syria, to say, this is where we'll support you. And if you don't step forward and show some goodwilling, then you'll find that our support stops. And that's the real problem.
Is there still this issue, though, because we talked before about these kind of situations where there'll be these outside influences and then there'll be their proxies or equivalents on the ground. We've talked before about how fractured it is, the opposition. Is there even points of pressure where they can exert that kind of influence and make that kind of statement?
So you've put your finger on it, because the reality is, as President Obama has said many times on many different occasions to do with countries other than Syria, as have others, it has to be driven from inside. Unless there's a willingness inside to actually work together and find a solution, it cannot be imposed from outside. And Lakhdar Brahimi knows this better than most. So there's pressure that can be exerted from outside. But the reality is that unless the Syrians themselves, the people on the ground, the people in the opposition predominantly, the people even in the regime, actually want to find a solution to this, there will be no solution. And as you rightly pointed out, this is made far harder by the fact that there are vast numbers of factions. There isn't an actor on either side.
Stuart, just finally on this, go back to Xenia's glass, yeah, with which we began that discussion, yeah, half full or half empty. Where is it in terms of what Stuart Purvis thinks about it?
Well, I think if you compare it with, you know, peace processes in the past, this is still, you know, surprising. There's still both sides, or all the sides. I don't think Al-Qaeda actually at the table, and that's kind of relevant to a point. They are all still turning up. And for those of us who cover, for instance, Northern Ireland peace process in Northern Ireland, where people regularly walked away and didn't turn up at all, you know, you'd have to say that is very, very small progress, but it's better than walking away.
There we are. So half full for us, I think. Let's move on slightly more familiar ground for you, at least, Zeni. We're talking about US diplomacy. The US is making steps to ending its decades-long embargo on Narendra Modi. Modi, not only a controversial Hindu nationalist politician in India, also the front-runner for the prime minister's job in forthcoming elections. Officials from his BJP party have announced Modi is to meet the US ambassador to India, Nancy Powell, possibly as early as Thursday of this week. Zeni, always, I sort of find these diplomatic sort of wrangles and intrigue always fascinating. In this case, is this any meaningful change, or is this just tacitly a recognition that he's likely to be in the big job, so we need to get him back on side?
It's very much the latter. You know, the US-India relationship is arguably one of the most important, unarguably, I would actually say, one of the most important in Asia, for the US in Asia. It's equally important for the Indians to have a strong relationship with the US. The US will always... perhaps that's a bit strong, but we'll typically work with both the leaders in countries and the opposition leaders. The reality is today, Narendra Modi is the de facto leader of the BJP. It is quite likely, or it's certainly possible, that he will be elected as Prime Minister of India in April, May. So you work with him. This isn't a change in policy on the part of the United States, but it clearly is just a recognition of the facts on the ground, and therefore the US has to find a way to work with him. And my prediction is that if he is elected, that the fact that he hasn't been given a visa, hasn't been permitted to travel to the United States since 2005, really that will be washed, water under the bridge, and they will find a way to work effectively together because they both need to.
I mean, that's the case, I guess, Stuart. It's sort of political expediency, and it doesn't really matter that that's the reasons behind it, as long as everyone gets along, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the embassy there call it part of their concentrated outreach to senior political and business leaders. And, of course, that's one of the main roles of ambassadors, well, actually, more often ambassadors' staff. My experience is that they work pretty hard at finding out the gossip in town as well, as much as making contact
surely
with
not.
The police.
Surely
yeah, absolutely.
Not.
That's why they have newspaper people to lunch so often. They want to find out what's really going on behind the scenes. So in a sense, Mondi, I don't think, has ever been convicted of a criminal offence, for instance, although his visa has never been granted. So, you know, there's a flexibility to move towards him a little bit more, if you like, bearing in mind that they have to cover the option or possibility that he is elected.
Absolutely. I mean, the GB, Britain, of course, had its own 10-year diplomatic boycott of Modi that they only lifted last year, and the same criticism was forthcoming then as well, wasn't it?
It was, and I mean, I would actually go a little bit further and to say that, you know, actually a Supreme Court inquiry found no evidence to prosecute him. So, you know, this is something that was instituted in 2005, actually, when I was in government. That decision was made at that time, but there certainly has not been a case against him. And that is what, as and when the US decide to lift the veto, that is what they will hold on to. And actually, one could make a very strong argument to say that, you know, that's as it should be. If somebody isn't convicted, do not find them guilty.
Fair enough, indeed. Zane, just finally, on one point about the still fresh in the mind, of course, was this extraordinary diplomatic row we saw in the US about this supposed visa fraud, and it became very unpleasant. And at the time, it was interesting to sort of consider, what are the lasting impacts of an event like that on the diplomatic stage? Will that be something that's still rankling on either side here, or is that too water under the bridge?
So as you rightly pointed out, just I think it was late December that the US, not the US State Department, I might add, but the justice system, the New York justice system, decided to lock up an Indian consular officer because she had allegedly lied on the visa application form to her maid in the house, or her housekeeper, I believe it was. There was a huge diplomatic firestorm that came out of this. Unfortunately, it came out just as the new Indian ambassador to the US was taking his position, just as the new Indian foreign secretary took her position, and just as the new assistant secretary in the United States took her position. So, I mean, not the people weren't in place. This happened. It wasn't caught early. It was completely blown out of proportion, arguably. And again, this will already, and I was in DC and I spoke to people on both the Indian government side and the US government side, and they say this relationship is far too important to have this be held back by this for any length of period.
Perhaps you're just those same scurrilous, rumour-mongering journalists are behind all of this.
People.
They are
shocking.
Awful. We're going to take a short break now. You're with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. I'm with Stuart Purvis and Zania Dormandy. We'll come back in a moment. We'll look into some new media ventures, The Intercept and The Marshall Projects, amongst others. Don't go away.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on shows you might have missed. You can download programs to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders of all your favorites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants, and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favorites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop suburban decay. Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because drag star taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Edwards. Still with me, academic and broadcaster Stuart Purvis, and Chatham House's Xenia Dormandy. Both limbered up a little. Did a bit of musical exercise during that short intermission. Stuart, we're sort of moving a bit more into your territory here, perhaps. Some intriguing media stories. We'll start by looking a little bit at the BBC, just up the road here in London. Lots happening. Changes on some of their platforms. The World Service, of course, drifting into this new interesting area. Questions about the commercialisation of their content, the involvement of advertising, their central funding being removed. Now, is this a huge changing of the guard? Are we going to see undoubted change? Can they continue in the same impartial way, or will there necessarily be a difference? What do you make of it?
Well, it's a bit complicated to follow because there are so many different pots of money involved. But what's happening is they are coordinating, concentrating the pots in a different way. So all domestic broadcasting in the UK is paid for by the licence fee. The World Service that was paid for by the Foreign Office and part of the British government is now going to be paid for a licence fee as well. But some of their ventures, for most obviously BBC World News Television Channel, for instance, already carries commercials, which is why you can't watch it in Britain. They don't want it coming into Britain because you'd suddenly say, somebody said to me last night, have you seen that BBC World? It's got commercials on it. And the answer is, yes, it has. So that's what the BBC is trying to say, zone that off. So if you're having commercials on a global TV channel, why not have them on a global radio channel, and why not have them on a global internet channel? That's been the argument inside the BBC. And once, you know, once the bridge was crossed and of putting commercials on the TV channel, I thought this was just a kind of inevitable process. But there are all sorts of strong views on it inside the BBC and amongst listeners and viewers as well. So I don't quite know how it's going to resolve. I'm already, as a result of coming together, and I think they call themselves the world's biggest newsroom, just down the road from here at Broadcasting House. And I think that's probably right. Once they put them all on the same site, it was quite difficult to tell who was working for who, and that was part of the plan. So in a sense, this merging of teams, this merging of news operations is leading to a blurring of these different funding lines.
Zoni, do you think it's problematic, though, for, you know, an organisation that has an explicitly sort of public service remit? Obviously, it's complicated by these different funding models. No one can have envisaged the sort of media marketplace we'd find ourselves in today when all of these principles were founded. Is it a problem, or do you think everyone just needs to be slightly more sanguine about it and not worry so much?
Well, I think, I mean, let me pick up from where Stuart left off. The reality is the world is changing around the BBC, and the BBC either has to react, as many other news channels, whether they're in newspaper, radio or TV, have done, or kind of get left behind. So, I mean, I was actually chatting this weekend with somebody about the fact that now you can, you know, if you miss something on the BBC, you can actually go online and you can download it and you don't pay for that. So how are you going to deal with the fact that you can watch something after the fact, but you're not paying for it, whereas you know, otherwise have to get your little license to watch it? So, I mean, you know, really, as Stuart said, that there's so many changing dynamics here that are coming together that if you look at it from the perspective of the audience, then I think you come up with a somewhat different answer, which is the audience wants what the BBC historically has provided, which is independent news that isn't owned, that has a certain cachet about it because you can recognise that it's independent and it's thoroughly researched and it doesn't have any partisan quality, et cetera, theoretically. And if the BBC continues to work in that niche, then it can probably sustain a niche. If the BBC moves out of that niche and starts moving into the areas, or already has arguably moved into the areas that many others are in, then you have to start asking the question of why.
And in terms of the question of impartiality, though, Stuart, do you think that is something that's an issue? I mean, people, Peter Horrocks, Tony Hall, all of these sort of the big wigs at the BBC are very insistent, possibly quite rightly so, that there's not any question about that. People needn't worry. It's, you know, sort of safe with us. They've almost come up with that sort of old chestnut. Do you think there will be? Is it? Can you avoid questions about impartiality, though, if you introduce these other commercial models?
Well, I've worked both as an editor in a regulated environment for impartiality. I've actually been the impartiality regulator for British Broadcasting, so I see it from them. As I've got older, I've got more and more sceptical about impartiality.
Surely not.
Absolutely. What it really means, it seems to me, is that when you go along with a conventional wisdom, you're being impartial. When you go against a conventional wisdom, you're somehow taking a partial view. The other thing I would say is there's a difference between being impartial and the news agenda. And there's definitely what's happening inside the BBC at the moment is they're having to make more and more cuts, partly to fund these new services they want to start. And therefore, they're covering fewer and fewer stories. They would say they're doing fewer stories in more depth, and I think they probably are. But actually, I think there's genuine concern in the UK that the news agenda is being narrowed. And that's something that, you know, leads us on some of these other subjects. You know, this is leaving a gap in the news agenda, which all sorts of other interesting people have decided to step in and fill.
Mm. Just on that point about sort of the cutbacks, Michael Grade had some interesting things to say about how the BBC could maintain its core values, but it could still trim, it could merge, it could outsource, I guess this will be fairly controversial, lots of its costly production elsewhere. Does he have a point?
Well, he does declare an interest. When he says that he thinks the BBC should close all its studios, he does point out that he's the chairman of the biggest independent studios operation in Britain. Michael, you know, you have to say, has one foot in politics. He's a member of the upper house in the British Parliament. He has a foot in business. He also definitely has a foot in show business. So I notice in this piece he's written, he reminds us that Edward G. Robinson in a gangster film, as a gangster, was asked by a sidekick what he really wants. Without hesitation, he responds simply, "I want more." And Gray concludes he would have made a classic director general, meaning that the BBC always wants to do more. So his conclusion is the BBC should basically stop making programmes other than news and current affairs and outsource them all. Mind you, he almost contradicts himself by saying he likes the way that BBC is moving production out of London to the nations of the UK, but actually they're building studios all over the UK. So isn't that actually staying in the studios business? So I think he's, you know, he's, say, slightly contradictory. But clearly something is going to happen as part of what's called the Charter Review here in deciding what does the public want from the BBC and how much money is there to go around to fund that.
Let's talk then about some of these other new models. We alluded to them already. A couple of new ventures. One, The Intercept, set up by First Look, itself a new media company founded by eBay's Pierre Omidyar. The Intercept, the home of Glenn Greenwald, of course. Yeah, our listeners will be familiar with his
recent talked about this subject before. They remember the story so far. Omidyar was interested in buying the Washington Post when it was really realized up for sale. Jeff Bezos of Amazon beat him to it. And then Omidyar said, well, if I'm not going to own that newspaper, why don't I kind of start my own news organization? Hired Greenwald and a guy called General Scahill. For a time, they called themselves the Omidyar Group, which sounded slightly sort of
sinister.
Exactly. Now they have a much blander title, First Look Media, and their first website, meaning that there presumably will be others, is, as you say, called The Intercept. And they've got an exclusive story. It obviously comes from Edward Snowden, which is obviously Greenwald's source. But interestingly, they have their own news source. This is somebody who was involved in operating drones in special operations around the world. So I suppose that's the model. They think that if you take Greenwald, you take Jeremy Scahill, you take Snowden stuff, other people will start coming to you, or you can go to them and add these new exclusives. So I think this will run.
Intriguing. Zanya, what do you make of these new models then? Are you one of those, slightly sceptical about it? You prefer to look to these traditional bastions that we all come to know and love? Or do you find it quite exciting? It's certainly a dynamic marketplace. Are you sort of intrigued and excited by where this might be in the next two, three, four, five years?
I mean, Stuart and I were talking about this earlier. I mean, to your question, I don't have a choice. This is happening. So, you know, you can either embrace it and move forward with it and take the advantages and the opportunities that it involves, or you can close your ears to it. But whether we like it or not, there is new media out there, and there's a hugely transformative, an expression that is probably used far too much, kind of disruptive technologies that are changing the face of the media world. You know, what I find is interesting, and as I was reading this story, is both about The Intercept and, of course, Bill Keller leaving The New York Times to start up an NGO, The Marshall Project, is my immediate reaction was, you know, I mean, targeting NSA, you know, I get a little bit worried that this is just so directed that it isn't helpful. And then I thought to myself, wait a sec, you know, back to the India story, one of the phenomena that you're seeing in India and elsewhere around the world is the kind of name and shaming, the use of new media to bring out transparency. You're seeing this in Russia a lot. Journalists actually using blogs or traditional media to actually bring transparency to governance, whether it's in the Russias of the world, the Indias of the world, or elsewhere. This is exactly the same thing. The only distinction, well, exactly, maybe too strong, but this is on the same dimension of transparency, but we're uncomfortable with it because it's in the United States. And actually, do we have a right to be uncomfortable with it, or is it just because we're showing our biases here? Now, you can make an argument that is, well, in the US, you actually have whistleblower laws. You have systems in place that protect journalists, that actually allow there to be other ways in which these kind of stories could be revealed and discussed. But other than that, is it so different, really, from what we're seeing and applauding elsewhere around the world?
Intriguing stuff. Those are the insights of Zainia Dormandy and also Stuart Purvis, my guest today on Midori House. Thank you both very much indeed for being on the programme.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Way you London, this is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
It's 18:31 here in London. Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We're speaking to the man behind a new photography project looking at Kiruna in Sweden. And we'll review the week's German television with our correspondent in Berlin.
Wir hätten dieses Problem nicht, wenn du die Heizungsrechnung bezahlen würdest.
Ich dachte, die globale Erwärmung macht das.
All that and more ahead. Before we begin all of that, though, let's hear from Jonathan Wheatley. He's here with the latest World News headlines.
Thank you very much. The United Nations has resumed the civilian evacuation of the rebel-held Syrian city of Homs, which has been under siege by government troops for 18 months. Meanwhile, the Russian Foreign Ministry has just accused the United States of deliberately distorting its position on Syria after President Barack Obama criticised Moscow for objecting to a draft UN resolution on aid to Syria. Moscow said it would veto the Western Arab draft resolution on aid access to Syria in its current form, saying it could only consider a text free from one-sided accusations against Damascus. A US judge has today ordered the accused Boston Marathon bomber to face trial in November, denying his attorneys the extra time they'd sought to prepare his defence on charges involving the largest mass casualty attack on US soil since 9/11. Johar Zanayev could be executed if convicted of killing three people with a pair of homemade pressure cooker bombs in the 15th of April 2013 attack. And the European Union Enlargement Commissioner Stefan Füle has met with the Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych to try to break the political deadlock in the country. Protests against Yanukovych's government are now in their third month. And that's latest news from Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Jonathan. Jonathan will be back, of course, with a full bulletin of world news for you at the top of the hour. Time next, though, on Midori House to check in with one of our many correspondents around the world today. We're heading to Atlanta in the deep south of the USA. Barrett Austin is there. Barrett, a good day to you. Thanks very much for joining us, as always, here on the programme. Now, I guess the first thing to ask you about, to make conversation, if you will, is to ask you about the weather, because the south is in the grip still of a deep freeze, I gather.
I think that being in Atlanta today, the big thing to talk about is the weather. You know, it's starting to become something of an ongoing joke in this region. A couple of weeks ago, we saw a big storm that gripped the region, really sending tremors through the region, putting a city like Atlanta completely in a standstill with just 2 inches of snow. So today you're noticing very icy conditions on the road. Fortunately, I think people have listened to the lessons that we learned a couple of weeks ago here. And for the most part, people are staying off the roads, even though it's a small ice storm that's going through the region. You know, people have listened to Governor Nathan Deal. They've listened to the mayor, and the city is in many ways in a standstill today.
It's pretty extraordinary, Barrett. And I guess people from the area, just like those of us watching from overseas, you think of Georgia and Alabama and Tennessee, you don't really think of snow. And is that perhaps why what would at first glance appear to not be a terrifically damaging weather sort of outbreak can wreak so much damage? Because in Atlanta, we were seeing, well, only a couple of inches of snow, which is not high at all by American standards, but it's completely sort of rendered the city, as you said, at a standstill. What are they going to learn from it, if anything, do you think?
Well, I think, like you say, if you look at other cities throughout the country, especially cities in the Midwest and in the Northeast, these cities, they have the infrastructure to either get snow off the roads or to prepare the roads in the event that there is going to be a snowstorm. In a place like Atlanta, you know, in spite of the fact that Atlanta is the country's ninth largest city, there is no infrastructure to prepare for things like this. So I think the real lesson that we look at from a storm like we saw a couple of weeks ago, 2 inches of snow led to people being stuck on the interstate for, in some cases, 20 hours. The question that everyone had is, why didn't the state and the city prepare for something like this? Georgia's governor did not declare a state of emergency the last go-around. He has today declared a state of emergency. Atlanta's Mayor Kasim Reed previously didn't really make such a big deal about this and wasn't warning local residents, you know, to stay off the road. You're going to be dealing with icy conditions. Today, it's a completely different situation. The state of Georgia is now under a state of emergency. Kasim Reed has said, stay off the roads unless you absolutely have to. Find somewhere that you can stay safely for the next 24 hours and just stay there. So I think the issue here, the state of Georgia is never going to be able to deal with big snow issues. However, it's really a matter of doing what's right for the local residents of a place like this to keep them out of harm's way.
Well, we'll watch the weather very carefully, Barrett, and make sure you keep yourself out of harm's way. Avoid the ice and keep wrapped up warm, of course. Let's move on and talk a little bit about, well, we always love to hear about a good old bit of union wrangling, unhappy workers, this sort of thing. And I gather that there's a good story out of the Chattanooga Volkswagen plant. Tell us about this.
There's a fascinating story in Chattanooga that's going on this week. If you look at the issue of unionization in this country, all of the three major American car workers, they're all unionized. What's interesting is the fact that none of the foreign car producers who have manufacturing plants in the U.S., none of those are actually unionized. So most of these companies have located factories within the past five to 10 years in the southeastern, the right-to-work states, where unions have historically had no place. For the first time since Volkswagen opened their factory in Chattanooga in 2011, there's really a push by the United Auto Workers Association, of course America's biggest labor union, to unionize the plant. And it's been interesting to see because, you know, in a region that has historically been so opposed to unionization, it's been interesting to sort of follow the hearts of the workers there, but also local politicians. In Chattanooga and throughout Tennessee, you've had lots of politicians effectively attempting to scare the workers into voting against this and saying that if there's a chance that you end up unionizing this, there's a decent chance that we'll stop providing financial incentives to companies like Volkswagen and to the many subsidiary businesses that have located in the area. So I think it is certainly a fair case of union wrangling that we're watching right now.
And tell me more, Barrett, about the kind of political football that this has become, because I know that a former mayor of Chattanooga, who's now a senator, Bob Corker, he sort of called the UAW a Detroit-based organization, suggesting it's a kind of north-south divide. It's really interesting, isn't it, the kind of political direction that this is being dragged in?
I think so. I mean, having grown up in Alabama, watching Southern politics, it's not at all surprising to hear something like this. I think that for generations, unions have had not the best reputation in a place like Tennessee. And you've got, you know, the governor of Tennessee, Bill Haslam, has come out saying that this is something that he opposes. Nearly every Republican policymaker in the state has come out directly saying this is something that has no place in the state. And what's interesting to watch here is, as I said previously, there are a lot of car companies that have located factories in the Southeast. You've got Mercedes, who has a large plant in North Alabama. You've got BMW, who has a very large manufacturing facility in South Carolina. And it's really perked up the ears of lawmakers in those states as well, because there's a concern that should Chattanooga's VW plant unionize, it's only a matter of time before the other factories in the adjacent states end up doing the exact same thing. So it's really not just a Tennessee or a Chattanooga political issue, but you're finding Republicans throughout the region who are really sort of latching on to this.
It's an intriguing story. We'll have to watch that one very closely, particularly, as you say, Barrett, whether it spreads to these other plants, these other big manufacturers. Let's talk a bit more about manufacturing, though, but look to the skies in a story that also has a bit of an international dimension. It's the Singapore Air Show this week. We've been talking to our Gabriel Lee there on Monocle 24. But the air show has caught the attention of the Alabama business community as well, hasn't it? Tell us why that is.
Well, it's funny, you know, the nature of globalization with businesses like this. Airbus, back a couple of years ago, made the decision to develop its first U.S.-based manufacturing plant in Mobile, which is in South Alabama. Airbus, of course, has significant investment in the country as it is. This will make the fifth factory, but it's the first one that's actually going to be manufacturing airplanes. So if you look in the news in Alabama, you've had a lot of people in the business community and economic leaders who have really been watching for Airbus's orders in Singapore this week. And, you know, for the most part, there's been some good news. I think yesterday they inked a deal for 20 A380s, which is going to be a big deal here because a company like Airbus has such a backlog right now. So even though the Airbus manufacturing plant will not be on the grid until 2015, it is by all means something that will mean more job growth in a place like Alabama, which, you know, by all means, there is much need for job growth here.
Barrett Austin, thank you very much, as always, for joining us. That was our Barrett Austin, our correspondent in the southern states over in the USA. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Coming up next, we'll explore a photography project focusing on the transition of Kiruna in Sweden. Stay tuned. Yes, you're with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. We go indeed to Sweden now. The effects of an iron ore mine are being felt in the country's northernmost town of Kiruna. Its buildings are threatened, its foundations themselves in danger of subsidence and collapse. But rather than reinforcing the infrastructure, the decision was made to move the town 4 kilometres down the road. A photography project to document the 10-year-long project to move the town is underway, and the organiser of that project, Klaus Tumann, joins me in the studio, as does our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield himself, who's recently visited Kiruna. Welcome both to the studio. Klaus, it's an intriguing project, the idea of such a long period of time. I know you've worked before looking at the movement of ice flows and these kind of things that happen very, very slowly. So did you feel you were naturally able to engage with a project that necessarily is going to take such a long time?
Well, that's a good question. And in some way, you could call me really lazy because I just take my time. But I do have a fascination in the projects I engage with mapping and also with the perspective of time. And specifically with Kiruna, is that the decision to move the city was made, I think, a few years ago. But actually, the transition is going to take place over a very long period. And I find that incredibly fascinating. It's also one of those things where the iron ore is so deep and has been going on for so long that you can't really stop what's naturally occurring. Is that there's a very big crack in the city in the soil, and it's just slowly moving towards the city at a pace of 15 meters per year.
Extraordinary stuff. I just wonder, Steve, you recently travelled there yourself. Paint us a little picture, if you will. What were your first impressions? Did it feel like a city where this sort of strange, almost sci-fi crack that's approaching it? Did you feel like there was something just around the corner like that?
It's a very strange place. It didn't really feel like a city for a start. It's very small. It's probably only about 20,000 people really sort of there, and yet it is, you know, technically a city. I was there in summer, which doesn't actually mean it's sort of sunny and bright and lovely. It's actually very cloudy. There was a lot of fog. There was this fog which sort of just rolled in without you even really noticing. It felt like you're in this sort of weird sort of Swedish horror film where you weren't entirely sure who was going to come out of the fog. And it's also, of course, at that time of the year, very light. So even at midnight, it's light. And I went for this drive around the city at midnight, and there's no one about. And it felt like you're in, again, a horror film, something like 28 Days Later, where there's just sort of no one about. So it's a really eerie space. And then you see these maps of where they are sort of moving the town, and they're doing it bit by bit. So those that are nearest the mine get sort of get moved first. And you can see that every year they're going to move back a little bit more. But it's a really odd place that you're not entirely sure sort of what's going on. And also, you know, it's so linked to the mine. You know, the only reason it exists is because the mine is there, really. That's where everyone's working.
But that's why you didn't encounter any people, because they're all down there all the time.
Yeah.
That's all they do. So some of the things that has happened is that, of course, there's a huge infrastructure to take all this iron ore back to the rest of the world. So they do that by train. And one of the first things and one of the things that has happened, they actually re-engineered the railway track to go behind the crack, because that way they can make sure that all the trains don't fall down the crack, basically.
Which is quite important.
Absolutely.
I just wondered then, when you start this project, it's interesting you've talked about how it's a human story as well as a sort of physical story and a geographical story. As a photographer, as someone who's documenting this kind of huge scale of an event, where do you start? Because there are these human stories which are necessarily kind of smaller in scale, and then these huge epic geographical things. What's your frame of reference? How do you begin when you're deciding how to tell the story? Is it a small scale story or necessarily a very big one?
Well, I think one of the things you can do with photography is that you can create epic landscapes, and that will tell one story. And you can also home in on small minor details, and that will tell a different story. And quite often those details will have they will be much more emotionally charged, like a man stroking his dog in a sofa. You know, that's his home. That's emotionally charged, and he's not going to be there in 2 years' time. And I think to show that these lives are going to be changed, and one of the things that is so difficult to explain and to kind of understand is that how everybody's life is just essentially being put on pause, because they know they're going to move. So, and that house is just going to get torn down, or if it's an old wooden house that's worth keeping, it's going to be packed down and put up somewhere else. But essentially, you can't sell that house. You can't sell your home. So you're in limbo. And it's almost like that guy that was stranded in, when Snowden was in transition in Moscow airport for such a long time. But that's what it must feel like. You have a home, but you're homeless.
It's intriguing, that idea of being almost stateless in that period of transition. Steve, did you get that sense when you talked to people there during your visit that they were in that state of flux? Was there a sort of an awkwardness, almost an uneasiness? Or did people actually seem fairly well set and able to actually sort of look to the future in a fairly optimistic way?
What was funny is I was there during a meeting of the Arctic Council, which was, you know, the eight foreign ministers of the Arctic Council, so the five Nordic countries and then Russia, Canada and the US. So it was really curious, because you had this town where everything was to do with mining, and it's, you know, as we were saying, you know, there's these sort of weird sort of little wooden houses. And then all of a sudden there's John Kerry and Sergei Lavrov. And it was slightly incongruous having them in that setting. It did feel like a place where not much happens, and it had just been frozen, so to say, in a moment. And there was one moment where we went down to a place where there was an electricity substation, and it was this weird sort of humming, and then the fog rolled in, and you did just feel like a little bit unsafe, and you weren't entirely sure what was going to happen.
I think one of the things that you probably experience is that time kind of moves slow up there, and I think that's one of the things you have to realize when you live in London and everything's fast paced, and then it's almost like, okay, like in 10 years time the crack is going to be here. And I'm not saying that everybody's moving slow, but you obviously get the seasons, but there's a different pace to life. And one of the things that I found when I was up there was that it was difficult to try and capture the human story, because you're right, not much goes on in the streets. There might be a guy walking around with his dog, but the dog has like small shoes on because it's freezing cold. And it's kind of humorous in a way, and it kind of shows the personal side of what's going on. But it's such a big event that it's almost a non-event. And I kind of like that juxtaposition of you have this huge, huge, massive issue, and the human impact is felt, and yet also there's so many relationships. There's nature, there's what humans are doing, there's the mind, there's what that's doing to nature, and then you also have the stuff that's going on within the different stakeholders of the mine. You know, most people are depending on the work from the mine, so there's not a huge outcry about what's happening. There's a general acceptance that, okay, we need to move the city.
It's an extraordinary story, and there's some extraordinary pictures. Our listeners must go and see them for themselves. Klaus Tumann, many thanks for coming in to join us on the show and telling us all about it. Steve Bloomfield, thanks for sharing your experiences too. We'll take a break. We'll enjoy a little music. Let's keep it Swedish. Why not? This is Sweden's own Little Dragon with, perhaps in tribute to the town, Constant Surprises. I met this guy, and he was not so shy, and not that kind. We spoke, and suddenly I could read his mind. You think it's bad, but I don't fool myself. You think it's odd, 'cause in my life, things are built on, they're built on, they're built on. From Sweden, that is Little Dragon with Constant Surprises here on Midori House on Monocle 24. We're fast approaching the end of the programme. Before we go, time for our daily review segment. We go through the best in books, theatre, art, music, cinema and more with our correspondents and contributors from all around the world. Today we're talking television in Germany with our correspondent. It's Kimberly Bradley in Berlin. Kimberly, a very good day to you. How are you today? Great to have you with us on the programme. Where should we start our review of German television? Perhaps with a real old favourite.
With Tatort, I think. Yes?
Absolutely. Let's do it. Now, tell me a little bit about this. This is a long-running crime series, I gather. Tell me about the sort of the place it occupies in German culture, then.
I call it church. It's on Sunday nights on ARD, and it has been since 1970. So I've noticed that more Germans sit at home on Sunday evenings watching Tatort than actually going to church. And some people make jokes that it is German church.
So. Fantastic. Now, I gather one of the intriguing things about it, Kimberly, is that it's had a very long-running, sort of the introductory sequence, I gather hasn't changed at all in all of these decades. That can't be right, can it?
It's true. I actually did a little research, and I think it's the only show that's run this long that hasn't ever changed the sequence in the world. It's very funky 70s music. You've got a pair of eyes in a gun sight line, and then very wavy lines that go across the screen and form the shape of a fingerprint. So it's very, you know, telling.
It sounds absolutely brilliant. It sounds so brilliant, in fact, Kimberly. I think we need to let our listeners have a listen themselves. Let's take a listen to aforementioned funky introduction of Tatort. Here it is. Oh, that is absolutely brilliant. Kimberly, I like that so much. I'm going to play that when I'm walking down the street, maybe at loud volume so that people can hear that when they see me coming. What do you think about that idea?
No, it's great. They don't make bass lines like that anymore.
Oh, they certainly don't. And tell me, in terms of the sort of plot lines, is it's kind of general crime, whodunit type stuff? Is it anything exceptional? Why do you think it has such an enduring appeal?
It's not so exceptional. I think the reason it's done so well for so long is that they make regional episodes. So there's a set of two commissars in each city. I mean, if you're in Berlin, you watch the Berlin Tatort. You have Ritter and Stark, which means knight and strong. But if you're in Leipzig, they have a different version, and they were making a version in Switzerland for a while, and they have an Austrian version. So if you're in Vienna, you're watching Tatort in Vienna. I think people really identify with their location.
Yeah, it's pretty clever. I like that idea. Well, they obviously led the way for all the kind of CSI Miami, CSI New York. Tatort did it all first, and well done to them. Let's continue to another long-running favourite, a daily soap opera from the 1990s. I guess this sounds like it's pitched a bit more to sort of young people. Tell us about this one.
Gute Zeiten, schlechte Zeiten. That means good times and bad times. It's still on after 22 years every single day. I think back in those days, I was living and learning German as a student when it came on the first time in 92, and I would watch it so I could learn German. It's simple plot lines, very soap opery, beautiful young people, and I think it was a direct reaction to Beverly Hills 90210 back in the day. But now it's a bit of a star maker. There are a lot of pop stars that have come through. A lot of young actors get their start there. And everybody kind of between the ages of 18 and maybe 26, they watch it. Wow. I like Kiel.
It's pretty good. And also, and as you said, a bit of a German language primer. That's pretty handy. I want to talk to you about one more German staple, Kimberly. But before we talk to you about it, let's play a little extract and we'll see if our canny listeners can work out exactly what program this is. I think they might not have too many difficulties. Let's take a listen.
Wir hätten dieses Problem nicht, wenn du die Heizungsrechnung bezahlen würdest.
Ich dachte, die globale Erwärmung macht das klar. Auf Ego ist wirklich kein Verlass.
Ich hab noch ein paar Zeitschriften zum Verbrennen. Ein Wissenschaftsmagazin, Hausfrauenmagazin, Katalog für Halloween-Kostüme in Übergröße. Und als nächstes...
Nein, das ist meine Erinnerungskiste.
I think our eagle-eared listeners, if there are such things, will know that's The Simpsons, of course. It sounds so different when it's dubbed. I guess that's stating the obvious. Tell me generally, Kimberly, in terms of dubbing, does it completely change the whole sort of nature of programmes? Does it change their whole meaning, do you think?
It can. And in The Simpsons, it's amazing how well they actually do it. I found it funny as an American to watch, to know the original and then watch the dub version, because they did a pretty good job on that one. Although everyone mispronounced it Homer or Lisa. You know, the names are a little different. Where I found it a bit trickier was with some of the HBO series, like Sex and the City. It became a little too German for me. the jokes didn't really translate very well. And what is also funny is that different actors throughout German television will, or the American actors, dubbed in German will have the same voice every time.
Oh, so that combination of Homer Simpson and Sarah Jessica Parker was never going to be successful, was it? No. Kimberly Bradley in Berlin guiding us through German TV today on Midori House. Thanks very much for joining us. Absolutely great stuff. That's all we have time for on today's edition of the programme. My thanks in particular to my special guests in studio, Stuart Purvis and Xenia Dormandy. The programme was produced by Alla John, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Anada Satuma, and our studio manager was Bill Luton. Entrepreneurs is up next. They'll be at the Spielwarenmesse International Toy Fair in Nuremberg. That's going to be a great listen. Be sure to stay tuned. This programme returns at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. Andrew Tuck, our editor, will be in this extremely comfortable chair for that one. That's all for this edition of the programme. Goodbye. Have a great evening. Thanks for tuning in.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.